Since 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been committed to improving the lives of America's veterans, first responders, and their families. For over 20 years, the foundation has helped America keep its solemn promise to never forget. Tunnel to Towers provides mortgage-free homes to Gold Star families and the families of fallen first responders with young children, and builds specially adapted smart homes for catastrophically injured veterans, as well as work to eradicate veteran homelessness. David Marshall served in the Army during World War II and fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He's never forgotten the sacrifices of his comrades in arms, nor the efforts of first responders on 9/11 and in the days and months that followed. He is a loyal and proud foundation donor. Tunnel to Towers is committed to supporting veterans, first responders, and their families, and so many of them need your help. Join the foundation on its mission to do good and never forget. Donate $11 a month to Tunnel to Towers at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
The battles of the past define the present. This is Shields High.
Gather around, friends, for I have a story to tell. The Fall of Constantinople, Part 2. In the year of our Lord 1453, then the most important city in the Christian world, Constantinople, was besieged by the most powerful army in existence, that of the Ottoman Turks of Anatolia. Constantinople's Theodosian walls had stood up to weeks of continuous assaults and battering barrages from the 70 cannons that the Sultan, Mehmet, had emplaced for what was then the most impressive artillery battalion the world had ever seen. The struggle for the city was an all-or-nothing enterprise. If the defenders were overrun in Constantinople, they knew that they would be slaughtered or enslaved to a man. The icons of Christianity, including what was considered a piece of the true cross of Jesus Christ, would be desecrated and destroyed. And with their successful taking of the city, the Ottomans could create a capital at the crossroads of the known world, from which they could stage further jihads, invasions all the way into the heart of Christendom itself. From there, they could dominate the world and the future of humankind. But the hardy defenders of Constantinople were not giving in. In fact, the major assaults on the walls had been repulsed, and the first effort to engage the Constantinople navy at sea was a stunning defeat for the Ottomans and had enraged Mehmet to the point where he considered impaling his own admiral. He needed to change the outcome. While no one in either camp was certain, there was the possibility of a relief armada if the Italian city-states of Venice or Genoa raised a fleet, or if the Hungarian crusader spirit was once again remembered to the West, a massive relief force by land or sea could lift the siege and deliver Constantinople from an ignominious and brutal defeat. Through the entire month of April, the massive Theodosian walls to the west of Constantinople had withstood the roaring cannon fire of Orban, the master metallurgist, who had offered his services to the Christians, and tragically for them, they didn't have the funds, but Mehmet did. And that was how the Ottomans all of a sudden became the foremost gunpowder power in the Mediterranean world. Those cannons were blasting at the Theodosian walls. It was doing damage, but it was not enough. And with the defender Giustiniani's on-the-spot improvisations, a stockade had been built in the areas of crumbling wall, and with hardy and fierce defense behind it, so far, all efforts to take the city by land had been repulsed. Mehmet, despite the humiliation of watching his navy greatly outnumbering just a few Genoese ships and being routed by them on the sea in full view of both combined military forces, well, Mehmet knew that he would have to mount another naval assault against the city, and he had to cut off supplies and any hope of a reinforcement by sea. But to do that, he had to get around the 300-yard-long metal chain that connected in the seawalls of Constantinople and the city of Galata, a Genoese colony, across the Bosphorus. He couldn't just drive at it with his ships. They would be picked off and destroyed as they tried to make their way around the barrier. Mehmet, however, had a brilliant and devious idea. He would create a second opening for his navy by going around the chain. This would let him have his ships bottle up all of Constantinople's naval forces and create a threat to the Golden Horn itself. The Golden Horn is a body of water just to the north of the main city of Constantinople. It is an estuary that connects to the Bosphorus, and the Bosphorus is a thin body of water that connects into the Sea of Marmara and then the Mediterranean to the south, and to the north, the Black Sea. Incredibly valuable naval and commercial maritime real estate. But for the city of Constantinople, the Golden Horn had to be a safe haven, or else it would extend their defensive lines even more. If the Turks were able to make their way around the chain and bring a naval force to bear to the north of it as well as the south, all 12 miles of Constantinople's perimeter would have to be defended. But how to do it? Well, Mehmet had an ingenious plan, one that, once executed, would strike terror into the hearts of the Christian defenders, who, mere days before this plan was enacted, could have in fact seen the Ottoman army pack up and leave. That's how close they were to a successful defense of the city after victories on land and then at sea. Mehmet was a student of history, however. He knew that it was possible to move ships overland if the right conditions were created. The Genoese colony of Galata, which sits across the Bosphorus from Constantinople, was neutral, though it was a Christian enclave, and the Sultan had suspicions that they were providing intelligence and probably even other forms of covert assistance to the Christian defenders. But Galata is surrounded with some land, and to the north, that land is above the great metal chain links that kept the Ottoman navy from fully encircling Constantinople. Remember, the city of Constantinople is on a peninsula at this time. To the west, it has the massive Theodosian walls, but to the north, east, and south, its boundaries were water. The route overland was only possible with the Ottoman logistical war machine in full effect. They were able to create a bridge of logs and carry their ships in whole, without even taking them apart, over the pathway of logs from the Bosphorus south of the chain up to the north of the chain. This would mean that the entirety of Constantinople was subject to attack. Saladin, the most famous of Muslim generals and conquerors up to this time and for all time, had moved ships from the Nile to the Red Sea in the 12th century. Mehmet, with pretensions to be as great a conqueror as Saladin, took a page from his playbook. On April 22, 1453, the first Ottoman war galley was slipped into the water north of the Great Chain across the Bosphorus. The road of logs that Mehmet had emplaced managed to get the navy around the chain that had defended the Golden Horn for centuries. There was nothing now to stop a full-scale naval assault of the north of the city except for the ships at harbor. The Genoese defenders of the city, understanding the naval implications of this plot immediately, came up with their own counterstrike. They would lead a naval assault in darkness with fireships. The fireships would go directly into the thick of the Ottoman naval presence that had now moved north of the chain, set them on fire, and destroy the threat to the north of the city and the Golden Horn. Time was of the essence. A vote was taken, and the defenders of the city, led by Giacomo Cocco, were ready for their fireship assault. But at the last minute, there was dissension within the ranks. They decided that they had to delay. There were Genoese in Galata who wanted to partake in the mission too. This delay was to prove disastrous. Within a couple of days, they launched the fireship assault at night. The Ottoman ships were moored, just as they thought they would be, in relatively tight formation. But there were cannons emplaced along the shore. The first ship meant to start the conflagration of the Ottomans, the first fireship with Giacomo Cocco as its captain, was annihilated. It was turned into splinters by the cannons, and the Ottomans clearly were waiting for this fireship assault and ambushed it. It was a dismal failure. 40 sailors managed to swim ashore from the destroyed Christian ships. Mehmet had the 40 surviving sailors seized, and to tell the Christians just what he thought of their effort to destroy his navy north of the chain, he had his men grab each individual Christian, lay him on the ground, take a long sharpened stick and a heavy mallet, smashed the sharp end of the stick into the rectum of the Christian captive, drive it all the way so that it came out of his torso, turned the stick upright, and let the mangled, bleeding body and the writhing Christian atop it be a display of his hatred and resolve for all the Christians on the walls of Constantinople to see. The enraged defenders of Constantinople responded by taking over 200 Ottoman captives out of their prisons, and then one after another, throwing them off the city walls with ropes tied around their necks, hanging them in a vicious display of "we will do to you as you do unto us." There would be no quarter or mercy in this fight. And now the city of Constantinople was truly surrounded. The hopes of a naval fleet to relieve them were dimming. The focus of the brutal struggle then turned underground. From early to late May, it became a war of sappers. This was a mining technique, a staple of ancient siege warfare. The miners would try to dig tunnels under the defenders' walls. They would either then collapse the tunnel intentionally to bring down the foundation of the defensive fortification, or use the tunnel as an entry point for soldiers to invade behind the wall. The miners were in desperate circumstances. The Constantinople defenders would seek to find any way they could to harass them, to bury them alive, to set them on fire, to use Greek fire to destroy their tunnels and everything inside. While the miners got close to the wall, and in fact beyond the wall on more than one occasion, the defenders of Constantinople were always just a step ahead. Under the ground, there was a war going on that could have ended the siege were it not for two Ottomans who were captured and gave intelligence on the plans of the miners. Perhaps they would have been successful. But instead, the sappers' attempts to get behind or under the walls and end this great siege once and for all ended with nothing more than them either burning alive or buried alive. It would have to be a full-scale assault on the walls, timed simultaneously with an Ottoman naval assault on the rest of Constantinople's periphery, that would decide this contest. Mehmet set his mind to exactly that plan. Chapter 2, All or Nothing, The Final Assault. The year of our Lord, 1453, the 26th of May. Mehmet was making the final preparations. After 7 weeks of brutal siege warfare, both sides were depleted and morale was running out. The Christian defenders inside Constantinople had lost all hope of a reinforcement fleet or a crusader army by land coming to their rescue. They had sent out emissaries to seek help and had been rebuffed by all leaders with whom they came into contact. The Turks, for their part, had become sick of the continuous assaults on the walls that were repulsed time and again. They were promised booty. They wanted the glory of taking this great city, but also the riches, the slaves, the women held inside. And if they weren't going to be successful, the possibility of the field army deciding to leave or even a mutiny that would turn on Mehmet was all too real. The Sultan decided that it would be one final all-out assault to take the city. The St. Romanus Gate in the center of the Theodosian walls was a well-known weak point and had been for centuries. The Ottomans would concentrate much of their effort there, as well as another weak seam in the wall to the north. Those two places would be the primary points of entry for the assault. The night before, the Ottoman camp wanted to wage psychological warfare, and so they were told to each and every tent to set a fire alight during the night before the final siege. As the Christian defenders looked out from the walls, they saw a terrifying sight. It looked as though everything in front of them was the light of an Ottoman soldier's fire. With those set, the plan was put in motion. The Ottomans would attack before the break of dawn. It would be an assault in waves. a relay system. When one Ottoman force had suffered severe enough casualties, the Sultan would order its retreat and another would be flung against the walls. Mehmet's personal bodyguards stood behind the assaulting waves of soldiers with whips and clubs to remind them of their duty to die as mujahideen, as holy warriors. This was, of course, a jihad. There could be no place for cowards. After all, paradise was awaiting them the moment of their deaths. If they made it past the personal bodyguard of the Sultan, then they would have to deal with the Janissaries, the fiercest warriors of the Ottoman horde. And with the Janissaries, any cowardice would be met with a scimitar's blade. Those who ran from battle, no matter how fierce and furious the fighting had become, would be cut down by any Janissary who saw them leaving the field without the Sultan's say-so. There was to be no stopping of any kind, not for food or darkness. The Ottoman army was assaulting the walls of Constantinople with everything they had, and the attack would come from all sides. There would be a full-scale naval assault against the sea walls to the east of the city as well. It was a multi-pronged effort to take a city from all sides that had not been successfully stormed in 1,000 years. Constantine the 11th, the emperor of the Byzantines and leader of their defense, was exhausted. He had, over the course of 7 weeks of fighting, lost about half of his total number, from a start of around 8,000 down to around 4,000. That's 4,000 men to guard a perimeter of 12 miles around the city. Mehmet had the tremendous advantage of numbers. He told his men, who had been promised under Islamic law 3 days of unrestrained pillage, that they must leave the structures and buildings of the city and the walls intact. All of the plunder, objects, and human beings were up for the taking. The Christians had at their defense the stalwart Genoese named Giustiniani. He was the one who had arrived in January at the start of the siege with 700 trained fighting men. Giustiniani knew that after this assault, if the Turks were unsuccessful, it was likely they would retire to their camp and return home. There would be further sieges, but after this, perhaps they could rally Christendom to their defense. There could be an influx of soldiers. The great city of Constantinople could be the focal point of a renewed resistance against jihad. From Constantinople's walls, they could project out force and send military forays to take back the land that had been seized by the Turks. They could turn the tide against jihad, but they would have to hold out this time first. The odds were stacked against them. The Christian defenders on Constantinople's city walls passed out what remained of their weaponry and missiles. Crossbows, longbows, arquebuses, swords, spears, lances, maces, and battle axes were distributed to a man. Christian clergy led processions around the city. There was still a widespread belief among the population that God was on their side. And that God himself would deliver them from the Turkish menace. Priests blessed the defenders with holy water. On the other side of the battlefield, Mehmet moved forward. The first wave of the attack began. There was a desperate struggle. It was already established what parts of the wall had weakened, and that was where the Ottomans concentrated their assault. But the first wave was repulsed. The fighting was fierce and bloody. As Roger Crowley writes of this moment in his book 1453, quote, "Arrows whipping through the night air amplified the subterranean roar of the Ottoman cannon vibrating the ground. The flat crack of handguns, swords clattered harshly against shields as blades severed windpipes. Arrowheads puckered into chests, lead bullets shattered ribs, rocks crushed skulls, and behind these sounds the more terrible hubbub of human voices, prayers and battle cries, shouts of encouragement, sobs and moans of the approaching death for so many. End quote. The sound of the battle was deafening. The Ottomans were playing drums and flutes, trying to rally their men to continue the vicious assault. Inside of Constantinople, the church bells were ringing. They were hoping for a miracle. They were hoping for divine intervention. After 4 hours of continuous fighting, a contingent of 300 Ottomans finally made it up the wall and through the stockade. Once they had finally gotten past that first level of Christian defense, they were surrounded and systematically cut down to a man without a single survivor. The Sultan Mehmet was becoming desperate. He had only one crack division left of around 5,000 troops, including many Janissaries. If they were unsuccessful in breaking through the defenses, the Christians would win the day. To the north of the main assault, disaster struck for the Byzantines. It was at another known weak point, the Circus Gate, that an Ottoman contingent broke through and was able to pull down the flag of St. Mark of the Venetian defenders and replace it with the banner of the Sultan. For the first time, the Ottomans had a flag of their own atop the Theodosian walls in full view of the defenders. Back at the main assault in the center of the wall, Giovanni Giustiniani, the brave Genoese commander, was wounded. He asked the Emperor Constantine if he could withdraw, as he was combat ineffective. But other Genoese saw their brave general retiring, and they followed. It seemed as though they were retreating. The Ottomans recognized this as their moment. A wave of Janissaries smashed into the remaining defenders and overran them. They slashed and stabbed and hacked at every man, and finally, Constantine the 11th knew that it was too late. He tossed aside his purple emperor's robes, raised his sword, and ran into the thick of battle, never to be seen again. The Janissaries surged forward, shouting, "Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!" Some of the Christians at the walls held out for a bit longer, but the Janissaries swarmed them and killed them mercilessly. The remaining defenders were either cut down in place or made a desperate run for the ships moored at the docks of Constantinople to the east of the city. The Ottomans poured in, victorious, a ravaging, conquering horde. Chapter 3. Total Desecration. The City Falls. Those initial minutes, once the walls had been breached by the Turks, were sheer terror for all of those inside Constantinople. The fall of the city was a calamity. No one was coming to their aid. A darkness of evil descended upon the greatest city in Christendom. Constantinople had lasted 5 hours under the full weight of Ottoman assault. Now it was a 3-mile foot race from the walls to the heart of the city itself. The only thing holding the Ottomans back in those first minutes was fear of Christian forces lurking within the city for a last stand. Perhaps they had made preparations for final assaults inside the city walls. But there was nothing. All of the able-bodied men in the city had been called to the defense of the walls. The Turks turned the rout at the Theodosian walls into a frenzy of terror along the way. The first contingents of soldiers who made it deep into the city killed every man, woman, and child they saw. They cut civilians down with scimitars. They smashed their heads in with axes. The elderly, the infirm, lepers, infants, all were ruthlessly slaughtered in an orgy of religious-fueled brutality. Ottoman soldiers raped every female in sight. Many Byzantine Christian women chose to throw themselves off the buildings to avoid this fate. Those who called Constantinople home saw their families taken into slavery, often the last sight they would ever have in this world before an Azap or Janissary brought a blade down on their necks was their wives and children roped and taken as chattel. Then the Turks, after the blood in the streets was running freely, began to turn their thoughts to plunder. Beautiful women and, yes, young boys were the most prized slaves. The Turks even fought each other over some of this plunder. They turned their swords on each other when they could not come to an agreement on the spot. Churches and monasteries were singled out for plunder and desecration. Christian icons that had performed miracles were hacked to pieces out of spite. Crosses were smashed off of roofs or set on fire. The tombs of saints were ripped open, the bones thrown out in the street for dogs to gnaw on. The Turks raped the nuns and murdered all of the monks they could find. The great doorway of St. Sophia Cathedral had been barred. It was hacked open with Turkish axes. Every item in that church was either ransacked or destroyed. The Muslim invaders believed that it was idolatrous, and besides, any property that belonged to the infidels was now theirs through right of Islamic law on plunder. In a short time, anything in the city of Constantinople that could be identified with Christianity was erased. Of the 50,000 Christian inhabitants, thousands were murdered and the rest were taken as slaves. They would linger on for months, perhaps years, before they would die miserably at the oar, in the mines, or perhaps in a rich Turk's harem. The 3 days of Islamic plunder had been compressed into one. Within a few hours, there was simply nothing worthwhile left to take, smash, or defile. St. Sophia Cathedral was quickly converted into a mosque. Mehmet would now become known as Fatih, the conqueror. The greatest city of the Christian world for the better part of a millennium was no more. It would become Istanbul, the seat of the most powerful Islamic caliphate in history. The fall of Constantinople would lead to 200 years of holy war between Christians and Muslims, with the very survival of Christendom at stake. And it would take over a century until a group of Christian warrior monks on a remote island in the middle of the Mediterranean dealt the Sultan a major defeat, one that would turn back for the first time in decades the forces of Islam. It all happened on the island of Malta. But that is a story for another time.
Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or follow Shields High on the iHeart app. This has been Shields High.
Born on America's darkest day of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation has been helping America's heroes ever since. When a first responder or military service member doesn't come home and young children are left behind, Tunnel to Towers pays the mortgage on the family home to lift the financial burden. For severely injured veterans and first responders, Tunnel to Towers builds mortgage-free smart homes, enabling severely injured heroes to move around their homes more independently. Through the Foundation's Homeless Veteran Program, Tunnel to Towers is providing housing and services to homeless veterans. More than 3,300 were helped last year alone. Because all veterans who honorably served, whether in peacetime or war, deserve our nation's gratitude. People who put their lives on the line for our country and our communities need your help now more than ever. join Tunnel to Towers on its mission to do good and never forget 9/11 or the sacrifices of this country's heroes. Donate $11 a month at T2T.org. That's T, the number 2T.org.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.